Today, Banking in Wonderland, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 14th of September 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today we discuss our latest news digest to the 14th of September 2019, a week in which more central banks took cash rates lower, and there was some more positive news on the trade wars, which combined pushed stock markets near to record highs again. And locally, property prices continue to recover in places. The government exposed more details of their upcoming first home buyers program, and we took more flack from the AFR for telling the truth about the proposed cash transaction restrictions. Just another typical week in paradise. And Mr. Patrick, for you, I'm wearing my favourite shirt again. Before I start, a reminder that our regular monthly live stream event and Q&A session is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 17th of September at 8 p.m. Sydney. Here is the link if you want to schedule the event. You can ask me a question live in the chat or send yours through beforehand via the DFA blog. Links are below. As usual, we'll start with the international scene, but if you want to jump directly to the Australian section, the time code is shown below. And in the comments section, we list the main sections in this week's report. In the US, all three major US stock indices posted their third straight weekly gains, capping a week that saw signs of a potential thaw in the trade war between the world's two largest economies, which of course has gripped markets for months. The US agreed to delay imposition of new tariffs for 2 weeks, and China said it would buy soybeans and pork products and not impose scheduled tariffs on those US products. Officials from both countries are set to meet in Washington next month. The catalyst that's helping stocks this month is still in place, the thawing in the trade tensions between the United States and China. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.14% to 27,219. The S&P 500 lost 0.07% to 3,007. And the Nasdaq dropped 0.22% to 8,176. And volumes on the US exchanges was 6.93 billion shares, compared with the average of 6.75 over the last 20 trading days. The S&P 500 ended the day down slightly on Friday, but less than 1% below its all-time high, as a drop in Apple stock countered cooling US trade tensions. In fact, Apple was the biggest drag on the major stock averages, falling 1.9% after Goldman Sachs cut its price targets for the iPhone maker's shares, claiming that Apple's pricing plans for its Apple TV could hurt earnings. No, Apple said in a comment sent to CNBC, it won't affect results at all. However, tariff vulnerable industries helped keep the blue chip Dow in positive territory, which has now gained in 8 straight sessions, its longest winning streak since May 2018. And bank stocks generally had a strong day. JP Morgan Chase rose nearly 2% and hit a 52-week high of $120.40. Morgan Stanley jumped 1.9%, Bank of America finished at 1.69%, Citigroup was up 1.57%, and Goldman Sachs added 0.53%. So September is proving to be a good month for stocks overall, potentially the best September since 2010 so far. The S&P 500 is up 2.77%, with the Dow up 3.1% and the Nasdaq up 2.69% this month. In economic news, US retail sales increased in August at twice the rate analysts expected, according to the Commerce Department, suggesting that strong consumer spending will continue to support the longer ever US economic expansion. And the preliminary release of September's Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index came out also, showing a rise to 92, while the consensus was pointing to improving to just 90.9 from 89.9 in August, to lower the worries about the consuming spending strength in the US. And ebbing trade jitters and upbeat retail sales data helped US Treasury yields reach multi-week highs, providing an attractive alternative to risk-averse investors. The 10-year Treasury yield rose to 1.8999% on Friday from 1.791 on Thursday and an intraday low of 1.452% on September the 4th. The yield is still well down, 29% in fact, from December the 31st last year. This lifted the interest rate sensitive financials index, which gained 0.8%. Market participants now look to the US Federal Reserve, which is widely expected to cut interest rates by 25 basis points at the conclusion of its monetary policy meeting next week. The decision will be announced Wednesday afternoon US time, but because of this week's interest rate rise, most analysts expect the Fed to cut its Federal Reserve funds rate to 1.75 to 2% from 2 to 2.25%, but the odds on Friday were down to 78.5% from 90% the previous day and indeed a week ago. And President Donald Trump, worried in part about the 2020 election, wants the Fed to cut rates substantially, perhaps even to zero or below. His tweet was pretty direct. The Federal Reserve should get our interest rates down to zero or less. The US should always be paying the lowest rates. It is only the naivety of Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve that doesn't allow us to do what other countries are already doing. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that we are missing because of boneheads. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 3.38% to 1374, and a new one-month low, that is. Meanwhile, gold and oil prices slipped on Friday and ended the week lower. Gold futures for December delivery was down 0.76% to 1,496, and crude oil for delivery in October fell 0.45% to 54.84 a barrel. The US dollar was up 0.13% to 1.1075, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.11% to 98.198. The Bitcoin US dollar cross was up 0.03% to 10,329. Quite a lot of the action this week happened in Europe. The pound hit fresh multi-month highs, rising through the 1.24 barrier for the first time since July. It was less clear what drove this rise, as the news on the Brexit front remains frankly confusing. Initially, UK papers reported that the DUP was willing to compromise on the Irish backstop issue. That's a major concession that would make the current Brexit deal much more likely. However, DUP officials quickly denied the report, reaffirming their stance that Northern Ireland should remain under the UK rather than EU economic rules. But the market took the report as sterling positive on the assumption that some sort of deal will be done. It's becoming clearer by the day that there will be no further concessions by the EU, and for those in the UK who want to achieve Brexit, the only way to do a deal is to accept the open border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Otherwise, Mr. Johnson's reckless gambit of taking UK out of the EU without a deal will most likely result in full rebellion and a second referendum that could squash Brexit forever. Northern Ireland is more of a nuisance rather than the true strategic concern for the majority of Brexiteers who simply want England out of the EU. But then Northern Ireland could easily turn nasty. And of course, some of the court rulings this week have suggested that the Prime Minister acted without due responsibility with regard to proroguing Parliament. Although there is strong opposition to Brexit within the UK, the biggest segment of the population appears to simply want to get on with it one way or the other. Therefore, Mr. Johnson's Brexit allies may have made the hard calculus that Northern Ireland's backstop should be sacrificed in order to get the Brexit deal done. Whether all of this Machiavellian manoeuvring results in a deal remains to be seen, but for now the market believes that it will, and so the pound US dollar is responding accordingly. The European Central Bank, the ECB, recently announced major stimulus packages, including an interest rate cut and a massive new bond purchasing program aimed at shoring up the Eurozone economy. global economic slowdown and the trade war has been weighing on the Eurozone economy for quite some time now. Such an ultra-loose monetary policy helped the European stock market rise. Noticeably, it has been the ECB's largest dose of monetary stimulus in more than 3.5 years. Banking on such encouraging developments, investing in sound European stocks may not seem like a bad proposition. The ECB has launched fresh stimulus packages in an attempt to prevent a dilapidated Eurozone economy from grinding to a halt. The ECB confirmed that it would trim its deposit rate, that's the interest paid to commercial banks when they place funds with the central bank, by 0.1% lower to an all-time low of minus 0.5%. So now banks will have to bear charges for balances kept in the central bank. Needless to say, such negative interest rates will eventually compel the banks to lend to consumers and businesses instead of parking money with the ECB. And the ECB now expects its main deposit rate to remain at such low levels until and unless it has seen its inflation outlook, quote, robustly converge to a level sufficiently close to but below 2% within its projection horizon. And such convergence has been persistent. In other words, for a very long time indeed. At the same time, the ECB has announced a massive new bond buying program. The central bank's quantitative easing program will involve 20 billion euros or $21.9 billion per month of net asset purchases for as long as required. The ECB President Mario Draghi urged governments to take fiscal measures to reinvigorate the Eurozone economy. He said that in view of the weakening economic outlook and the continued prominence of downside risk, governments with fiscal space should act in an effective and timely manner. The outgoing president of the ECB added that in countries where public debt is high, governments need to pursue prudent policies that will create the conditions for automatic stabilizers to operate freely. All countries should reinforce their efforts to achieve a more growth-friendly composition of public finances. And the ECB's latest moves have helped European stocks rally higher. But consider this, the problem of the Eurozone is not one of lack of stimuli, but an excess of them. Eurozone states are already financing themselves at negative rates. There is no need for lower rates, and this disguises real risk. This has saved governments more than 1 trillion euros in interest expenses. And the ECB launched a liquidity injection in March 2019, and its balance sheet stands at 40% of Eurozone GDP. Excess liquidity is 1.7 trillion euro, but more liquidity does not lead to greater spending or investment. There is no higher solvent credit demand because monetary policy perpetuates overcapacity and zombifies the economy. The share of zombie companies has soared 30% since 2013, according to the BIS. And the ECB believes that the Eurozone problem is one of excess saving and lack of demand, when it is actually caused by excess debt and an oversupply of liquidity. This is crazy policy which other central banks are likely to follow, but it will not solve the underlying structural issues in the economies, which are fundamentally debt-driven. The German 10-year bond is now close to minus 0.45%, rising from its all-time low at minus 0.741%, and the UK 10-year gilt is now looking to have a place back above 0.75% after diving to 0.346% in the first week of this month. But let's pause here to look at rates around the world. There are now at least 24 countries with a zero rate of interest or below, with Switzerland, Denmark, and Sweden, and Japan all in negative rates. And bankers in the US are now openly saying that if rates go lower or negative, they will need to lay off staff and start charging customers more account-keeping fees to maintain revenue. Let's be clear, we households will once again end up picking up the tab for poor central bank policy. And taking rates lower and doing more QE is not solving the fundamental issues that we have around the world. Meanwhile, China is encouraging companies to buy US farm products, including soybeans and pork, by excluding those commodities from additional tariffs. And this follows a move earlier in this week to exempt a range of goods from 25% extra tariffs put in place last year. As the government seeks to lessen the impact from the trade war, China didn't specify the amount of purchases of pork and soybeans, which are key exports from agricultural states, which are important in turn for President Donald Trump's 2020 re-election bid. The Trump administration officials have discussed offering a limited trade agreement to China that would delay and even roll back some US tariffs for this first time in exchange for Chinese commitments on intellectual property and agricultural purchases. Working level teams from both countries are set to meet next week. The Shanghai Composite Index increased for a second consecutive week, and the Chinese government is growing increasingly concerned about soaring prices and that it will potentially mar celebrations for the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China on October the 1st. China is hoping to import 2 million tons for the year, some of which could be added to state reserves. And China bought about 1 million tons of pork so far this year, of which more than 87,000 tons were from the US, according to the Chinese customs data. Even if purchases tripled, imports only make up about 6.6% of domestic supply, said Citigroup in a report this week. The world's biggest consumer of pork accounted for about half of global demand last year, while it produced about 54 million tons, Citigroup said. So more imports are only going a part way to address their shortages. And the country is likely to see a 10 million ton pork deficit this year, more than the roughly 8 million tons in annual global trade. That means the country will need to fill the gap by itself. China had halted US farm product imports in August after trade deal negotiations deteriorated. Before that, Beijing had given the go-ahead for five companies to buy up to 3 million tons of US soybeans free of retaliatory import tariffs. The goods exempted from additional tariffs this week by China include pharmaceuticals, lubricant oil, alfalfa, fish meal, and pesticides. And the exemptions are effective from September the 17th to September the 16th, 2020, and will cover 16 categories of products worth about $1.69 billion, according to Bloomberg. And there may well be further rounds of Chinese exemptions announced later. Of course, the question remains whether this mini deal signals anything at all in terms of the strategic discussions ahead. Possibly the market has overreacted once again. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin, here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so to the local Australian scene, let's look at property first. CoreLogic reported that the weighted average clearance rate has held above 70% for four consecutive weeks now, while auction volumes have remained somewhat steady over the past 3 weeks. But remember that auction volumes are running around half the boom time levels. Last year, there were 1,916 listed. Last week, 1,553. But go back a year before, and there were close to 3,000 listed. So we need to keep a sense of proportion here. Moreover, shout out to Steve, who alerted me to this post, Auction Clearance Lies, by Neil Jenman. He rightly makes the point. All you need to know is the number listed for auction and the number sold. The self-reporting is biased to those sold and includes sales not made at auction. It's that simple. And the true numbers are lower than reported in the mainstream media. He suggests Sydney is nearer to 63%, Melbourne 58%, and on those lower volumes, the industry is duping us, and someone in the industry is finally belling the cat. So too, the property transaction volumes, which according to CoreLogic are down, way down, with Sydney down 48%, Melbourne down 38%, Brisbane down 41%, and Perth down 37%. and they're all down massively from their most recent peaks. Across the combined capital cities, sales are down 36%. In fact, the last time annual sales were this low was January 1996. Now, the sales volume data lags the dwelling price data by 3 months or so, and so it precedes the federal election back in May. More recent data from CoreLogic suggests that volumes may have rebounded following the federal election, but still significantly below peak levels a couple of years ago. And on Twitter this week, there was a debate about the CoreLogic Hedonic Index and whether it fairly represented the state of play thanks to low volumes and the exclusion of certain off-the-plan settlements. The mechanism which drives the index, of course, is not fully disclosed, so we will really not know the significance of this. So let's look at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series. And we can see that Sydney continues in recovery mode, as well as Melbourne, that Brisbane is continuing to move pretty much sideways, Adelaide is moving a little down, and Perth is actually also moving down, and the five cities average is moving higher as a result of the impact of Sydney and Melbourne increasing. So turning to the latest CoreLogic Index to the 12th of September, in Sydney, prices are up 0.49% over the last week, up 2.5% over the quarter, down 6.1% over the last year, and down 12.8% from peak. In Melbourne, they're up 0.56% over the last week, up 2.52% over the quarter, down 5.2% over the last year, and down 8.9% from peak. In Brisbane, they're up 0.07% over the last week, up 0.23% over the quarter, down 2.1% over the last year, and down 2.2% from peak. In Adelaide, they're down 0.04% over the last week, they're down 1.12% over the last quarter, they're down 1.2% over the last year, and they're down 1.6% from peak. In Perth, over the last week, they're down 0.3% over the last week. Over the quarter, they're down 1.81%. Annually, they're down 9%. And from peak, they're still down 20.9%. And over the major five, they were up 0.35% over this last week, up 1.55% over the last quarter, down 5.5% over the last year, and down 9.4% from peak. And as I always do, just to remind you that these are averages and individual price movements vary considerably up and down by postcode, by types of property, and many other factors. And indeed, these averages, frankly, don't really tell you much at all. The monthly housing lending flows were a little higher this month, according to the ABS. CoreLogic did some analysis and said in New South Wales, owner-occupied lending for non-first home buyers in July was the highest it's been since November 2018 and was 14.3% higher over the month. Owner-occupied first-time buyer lending was 33.6% higher over the month and the highest since October 2009, and investor lending rose to its highest monthly value since December 2018 and was 4.8% higher over the month. Victoria has also seen the value of lending trend higher in July 2019, with owner-occupied non-first-home buyer commitments and investor commitments recording their highest monthly values since November 2018, while owner-occupied first-home buyer commitments recorded their highest monthly value on record. Compared to the previous month, owner-occupied non-first-home buyer commitments increased in value 17.1%, owner-occupied first-time buyers rose 15.3%, and investor commitments rose by 13.3%. And you can see more on this in our post, The Credit Monster Stirs. And UBS said that they expect the RBA rate cuts and APRA credit easing to trigger a mini boom for house prices of somewhere between 5 and 10% and home loans up 15 to 20%. Nonetheless, they said, this cycle will be different. We expect much of the typical multiplier from strong house prices to the real economy to be unusually muted in the upcoming cycle. Housing sale volumes collapsed and show very little recovery so far, with a record low turnover rate. That's going to be a drag on renovations and related consumption. They said our lead indicator of land sales indicates ongoing weakness that even is worse than our long-held and relatively bearish forecast for total dwelling commitments, which are expected to fall to 170,000 in 2019 and stay low in 2020. Construction employment is likely to start to contract sharply ahead, and the wealth effect is likely to be much smaller than in prior cycles, given that savings already slid to just 2.3%, the lowest since 2007, and household debt-to-income ratios are already at a record high of around 200%. But public demand is the almost entire driver of GDP and jobs, but its growth rate has likely peaked, with the federal government committed to significant fiscal consolidation in 1920 via their budget surplus. Hence, the modest economy-wide deleveraging cycle in place since 2016 is likely to continue, they say, out to 2020, the longest in over 40 years. But the question for me as I update my scenarios is whether the credit home price bounce is sustainable given all the other negative indicators, from GDP per capita recession through to slowing business investment and household spending, flat wages, rising costs. Well, you know the list by now. And Bloomberg wrote this week that Australia's biggest economic stimulus since 2009 isn't working. Frydenberg might well find that he has some room to move because the government is projecting a budget surplus for the fiscal year through to June 2020. However, an unexpectedly strong spike in key commodity prices may mean it's already returned to the black. If it does, and the final figures are due out this month, that would allow him to tell the electorate that he's met his pledge, opening up the option of injecting more cash into the economy. And UBS estimates that the government's tax refunds are worth just 0.6% of household income, far smaller than the financial crisis stimulus of 2.8% of income. Its analysts last week warned that the economy's starting point keeps getting materially worse, noting that second quarter real GDP and consumption are the weakest since the financial crisis. A National Australia Bank, which runs the monthly business sentiment survey, see our post, Business Confidence Weakens Again, where we discuss the latest, sees the RBA cutting to 0.5% in February. If the government fails to provide more stimulus, it sees rates going to 0.25% by mid-2020, and the central bank turning to unconventional policies, which of course will include negative interest rates. Now, the ABC did a good piece last Sunday on the economy with Stephen Long, looking at household finances and the risks in the economy. And you can see the segment at A Long View of the Australian Economy, including my contribution. And this week, we also got more details of the first home buyer incentive scheme to be launched in January 2020, allowing up to 10,000 borrowers a year to benefit from guarantees for lenders from the Australian government. The National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation will administer the scheme, and a bill to enable this policy was introduced to Parliament this week. The NHFIC is undertaking consultations with lenders over their potential participation in the scheme, and it said this market sounding is the precursor to a procurement process which will be used to establish a panel of lenders. The scheme will involve contractual arrangements with a panel of lenders, and smaller banks and non-bank lenders will be prioritised to encourage competition. Additionally, the property price of eligible homes will be determined on a regional basis to ensure that benefits of scheme participation are spread across the country. The memorandum conceded that given the limited supply of guarantees, the potential financial benefit for successful applicants, and the relatively high income eligibility threshold, it is likely that there will be a large pool of eligible borrowers. Therefore, a key implementation detail will be how the 10,000 annual guarantees should be allocated. An independent review of the scheme, by the way, will be undertaken within 3 years of the scheme's commencement to ensure that the objectives are being met. Because liabilities under the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme are met by a standing appropriation, the NHFIC is not required to maintain capital and reserves to meet liabilities over guarantees to lenders, the explanatory memorandum on the bill states. But no one is talking about the potential impact on lenders' mortgage insurers, who will see their demand for their products fall as this scheme is launched. My view remains that this is dumb policy and will lift prices at the bottom of the market. Lenders will still need to satisfy themselves borrowers can afford the higher repayments, so it'll be interesting to see where the mortgage pricing comes out. Finally, a word about the AFR. I have already published posts about the disgraceful comments they made in a wild attempt to deflect attention from the cash transaction restrictions which were mooted in the draft bill. And you can watch my show what I said to the Treasury, where I went through the main arguments. In short, this is little to do with the black economy and everything to do with controlling cash movements as part of future negative interest rates. This was all laid out in the IMF reports and blogs, so it is important to keep the pressure on MPs, else we will lose another personal freedom to transact as we please. And a shout out to the hundreds of messages I've received in support of our efforts across our social media platforms. It's amazing to see how much you care about these issues, and your messages are truly wonderful. And if I may, a special shout out to Emma for her recent letter. Thanks, Emma. So now to the main movements in the local markets. So the ASX 100 finished up 0.26% to 5,529. The ASX Financials finished up 0.58% to end at 6,464. And the Volatility Index for the Australian market fell 4.52% to end at 1,235. ANZ was up 0.94% to 2785. CBA was up 0.97% to 8214. NAB was up 0.66% to 2916. And Westpac was up 0.10% to 2969. Amongst the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was up 1.44% to 984. Bendigo was up 0.53% to 1147. Suncorp was up 0.8% to 1389. And Macquarie was up 0.61% to 129.29. AMP was up 0.81% to 186. Genworth was down 2.06% to 332, in response, I think, to the release of the bill relating to first home loans. McGrath was down 4.65% to end at 20 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was up 15.94% to end at 8 cents. AFG closed at 2.19. Mortgage Choice, the aggregator, was up 1.79% to 1.13. And the Australian US dollar was up 0.17% to 68.78, so it's recovered a bit from its lows last week. The euro US dollar was down just 0.02% to 1.6102. And the gold Aussie cross was down 0.88% to 2,164. While the Bitcoin Aussie cross was down 0.19% to 14,987. So in conclusion, we're facing into the real possibility of negative interest rates ahead, where cash transactions are controlled, you pay to hold money in the bank, and interest rates to borrowers are cut further. You are essentially being forced to spend and to consume to try and save the banks and their debt mountain at the expense of savings, and you're being encouraged to take on ever more debt. This is a disastrous strategy driven by people wanting to protect the banking system at all costs, never mind the consequences for real people. To underscore this, I will leave you with a short extract from an ECB MP, which lays it all out.
Commissioner, Mr. President, I rise again, I'm afraid, to make the same old hoary speech that I've been making here for several years. And that is, it is my opinion that you do not really understand the concept of banking. All the banks are broke. Bank Santander, Deutsche Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, they're all broke. And why are they broke? It isn't an act of God. It isn't some sort of tsunami. They're broke because we have a system called fractional reserve banking, which means that banks can lend money that they don't actually have. It's a criminal scandal, and it's been going on for too long. To add to that problem, you have moral hazard, a very significant moral hazard from the political sphere. And most of the problem starts in politics and central banks, which are part of the same political system. We have counterfeiting, sometimes called quantitative easing, but counterfeiting by any other name, the artificial printing of money, which if any ordinary person did, they'd go to prison for a very long time. And yet governments and central banks do it all the time. central banks repress the amount of interest that rates are, so we don't have the real cost of money. And yet we blame the real retail banks for manipulating LIBOR. The sheer effrontery of this is quite astonishing. It's central banks. It's central banks that manipulate interest rates, Commissioner. And plus, underneath all this, we talk loosely, in a rather cavalier fashion, do we not, about deposit guarantees. So when banks go broke through their own incompetence and chicanery, the taxpayer picks up the tab. It's theft from the taxpayer. And until we start sending bankers, and I include central bankers and politicians, to prison for this outrage, it will continue.
We live, frankly, in a wonderland world of banking. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.